The Bio Revolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. Welcome to the Bio Revolution Podcast, this time around virtual cells decoding life's basic units. Welcome, Easy.
Hello.
And our guest today, Fabian Theis. Hello.
Hi.
Fabian is the director of the Institute for Computational Biology at Helmholtz in Munich. So we have a podcast, virtual, one station in Munich, one in Berlin, one in Frankfurt. Easy, as always, we start, of course, with quotes to get closer to our topic.
Yes. Today I brought two quotes from, I would say, two people who could be seen as foundational for their respective fields. First is from Rudolf Virchow, a fellow Berlin practitioner who was foundational for the field of cell theory, the recognition that cells are even the basic units of life. So what he said is, where a cell arises, there a cell must have previously existed. In Latin, omnis cellulae e cellula. So cells come from cells, just as an animal can spring only from an animal, a plant only from a plant, which I think is a foundational step in cell theory. All cells must come from other cells. This is when I teach at university, what I say in the first lecture to the students. And then the other quote comes from Demis Hassabis, who just recently got the Nobel Prize in chemistry, one of the minds behind DeepMind, including the AlphaFold, for which the Nobel Prize was awarded. And he said in 2022, one of my dreams in the next 10 years is to produce a virtual cell. What I mean by a virtual cell is you model the whole function of the cell with an AI system. And I think this shows two different approaches to the question of the cell. And I'm really happy that we have Fabian Theis here today, who is, as you just introduced, the director of the Institute for Computational Biology at Helmholtz, also leads the Computational Health Center at Helmholtz. And I think you also have a professorship for mathematical modeling at TUM, and I think many accolades, including the Leibniz Prize. So we're really happy to have you here today and discuss with you, I think, a little bit of all the exciting research projects that are going on in your group and that you're involved in, and getting an idea of, and I will start with this question, why we actually need virtual cells.
Yeah, thanks, Luise, first for having me. Thanks, Andreas, for the kind introduction. Quite excited to sort of talk about maybe the bigger questions we have in the field. And I think it's a good time talk about this at the moment, because, you know, there's sort of this, a bunch of revolutions coming together. And that's why this excitement, sort of this reformulation of, I guess, an age old question in the field, namely, can we, you know, sort of like we build cars where we have a sort of engineering plan, write up things, and then, you know, not just sort of randomly hack a few existing cars into bits and pieces and produce new ones. You know, can we build such a blueprint for cells, one that we ideally understand that when a particular modification happens, you know, these things and have this and that impact. Why is it relevant? I'm sure we're going to discuss a bit more later, but, you know, if you want to treat diseases, you want to understand where to sort of tune and do things. So this idea of a virtual cell, I'm quite excited. The definition, I guess, and, you know, there's sort of very different understandings, but I think sort of the highest level picture would be, and you cited Demis as an example, would be to build a system that can simulate cellular behavior under normal growth differentiation, as this beautiful Virchow citation was just formulating, but also, of course, under perturbation such as external influences, microenvironment, but then, of course, also particular disease.
Yeah, really, really interesting. What I found quite interesting, so last year you co-authored with many important people in the field, including, I'm just quote, I will not read all the authors, but it includes, for example, Aviv Regev, Emma Lundberg, Patrick Zhu, so many, many people who have been thinking about these questions for a long time, actually, since I was still in research. So I still know many of these publications and these thoughts at the earlier stages of what a virtual cell could look like. 10 years ago, we had very different tools back then. As you say, we have a revolution probably in data, a revolution in artificial intelligence that can fuel these virtual cell models. So in this publication in Cell, what I found quite interesting, and I really liked this publication, you asked, it's about how to build the virtual cell with artificial intelligence priorities and opportunities. So this is not actually research output, but it's actually stepping back and convening the field together to ask the question, how can we actually even achieve this feat? Which shows what a tremendous job it will be to model a virtual cell, even with the help of AI. Could you outline maybe a little bit what the challenges for a mathematician could be when it comes to building a virtual cell?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think you really formulated this nicely, that this paper sort of is a perspective plan type of thing, call to action also, if you want, that actually sprang out of a symposium that many of us had where, you know, these type of questions were written up. And of course, some of these have or are already ongoing. Some of these are just about to start. But I think was really good timing to do that. So the challenges, I mean, they're manifold, right? There's always this traditional way how we used to do cell biology, namely sort of this divide and conquer type of thing, you know, try to understand one cell type, maybe one pathway, ideally maybe one molecule, one receptor or something, and then sort of get all these details. And then something like 20 years ago, maybe a bit longer, this idea of systems biology came along, where, you know, we sort of tried to put together all these bits and pieces into the bigger picture to then understand how these sort of little entities work. And then, of course, as you put them together into the human or into the particular organism you're studying. So I would say the challenges are, as always in biology, that we have these very complex multicellular, sort of multi-scale, multimodal models. And these are two different things. So first, we have all these different types of molecules floating around in what we computationally often assume is a well-steered sort of batch, which obviously, you know, this is not the case. And, you know, literally there's some of us that just think, you know, cell is a bag of RNA, and, you know, it's a tad of a limitation. If you look at cells through a microscope, there's like this fantastically complex structure, right? And then there's sort of things like localization. There's all these additional processes happening. So this complexity to even put into a model, I don't think we know yet even close to how we could do it in what we often call forward fashion. So where we write down sort of a bunch of equations and sort of see how they come together. So that's sort of how to deal with the different modalities. Then the second one is, of course, how to deal with the scales, both in terms of spatial scale. So, you know, from the very EM, so electron microscopy type of observations of all these little details to maybe how proteins fold, how they sort of form the membrane, how you sort of put these together. This, by the way, is what Demis understands under virtual cell. He wants to sort of really piece them together on that level. Up to the scale of, you know, the nucleus, the cytoplasm, how it interacts then with other cells and so on. So bridging these, and then also the temporal scales, whether, you know, it's sort of the microsecond type of fluctuation of one molecule sort of binding to the surface and starting the signaling pathway, or this much longer range of chromatin modification. This is not really clear. And I think one kind of cool and innovative new way, and I think that's why we came together to sort of deal with that complexity, is not trying to do it bottom up, but sort of trying to put this all into a more complex AI-based, maybe let's call it more black box model, where you might not directly understand all the pieces, but that is still predictive. This is an approach that worked very well in other fields. You know, we used to be, and we can talk about examples maybe in a minute, but I think that's maybe an idea that we could do here.
Yeah, really interesting. I think so. When I left academia in 2013, the CAR paper had just come out. So this first virtual cell model where, what was it, Mycoplasma gentalium had been modeled like the simplest bacterial organism, and they tried to do it bottom up. And I mean, this was really, I thought it was super fascinating, but maybe at the time not really scalable because of all the complexities that you are mentioning now. So now we have AI at our hands, but we're still, of course, facing, as you say, a number of challenges of just the complexity of biology, the stochasticity of the process. I think also the non-linearity of it. I mean, taking out one gene doesn't equal taking out another gene. So one might lead to everything breaking down completely. The other one might have no effect whatsoever. So there we have like very different levels of buffering, I think, for biological processes, absolutely, which again is also quite difficult to model, I can imagine. Where would you say, so this paper that I just mentioned came out last December, right, in 2024. What do you think, or what could you say happened since? Are there any like progress steps being made within the field since?
Yeah, and if I may, not just since, maybe also, of course, before, because you know, this thing obviously builds up. And people put stuff together. And you mentioned Aviv Rigev. She's a good friend, one of real lighthouse figures in the field and fantastically integrative person. She, together with Sarah Teichman and many of us, the two of them sort of really pushing it, has led this international consortium called the Human Cell Atlas that you might have heard about, and in some parts spiritual successor to the Human Genome Project. Eric Lander also pushing for that and so on. Really nice community worldwide, very integrative. And that was, in a sense, the first type of data gathering that sort of helped even to spin out this idea of a virtual cell model. Because, you know, at the heart, and now sort of we agree, if we want to build an AI model, right? An AI model sort of has this, what's sometimes called the holy triangle of AI, right? So obviously you need to have your compute, large-scale compute, particularly for these very large-scale foundational models, very important. You have to have your methods, the way how you do all of that. And that's often rapidly advancing. At some point, then you know, things work out, and then you sort of need to extend on that. And then, of course, the data part. Like, where do you get the data at scale to really do these things? And that was the big first endeavor of this Human Cell Atlas, that we really tried to gather and describe variability, in this case, in a human, in each human organ at scale, and then also across different, you know, variation in population and so on. And this, of course, now starts giving you so many examples that you can start building this. When I started research, we had like, you know, a few transcriptomes, like 20 years ago or something. That's like a big thing, and it's sort of when the Human Genome Project first finished, like a little bit after. Whereas nowadays, in a single experiment, sometimes you can make more than 10 million of these single cell transcriptomes. This is huge data, the type of approaches that you can now use to analyze that type of data. It's just completely different from before. So that was the first part, gathering the data. In parallel then, a whole bunch of methods have been developed.
We would love to hear about that, because I think it's the data, I think, for me as a biologist and for our listeners who are maybe coming from slightly different fields, is still understandable, right? The technology gets cheaper, it gets more easy to use, and you just produce more and more and more of it. But I think in my mind, or in someone not AI savvy's mind, the idea would be, okay, now you have a billion data points. No one can make sense of that anymore, right? Mm. So you can just store that in your data warehouse and hope that something will happen with it. So how can we actually make sense of this massive amounts of data that we now have?
And that was actually one of the first, I think, big results in the whole field of single cell genomics, if you want, where, you know, people quite quickly realized that AI is needed, and the time often just called machine learning, right, to make sense, exactly as you say, of this high dimension data set. And, you know, this could be just RNA, obviously could have chromatin, protein, and so on. There's single cell proteomics now being thing, could be spatial context, but these things can be stacked into big vectors, as you say, 10,000 million dimensional space, where you have a few dots that would be the cells. Like, what's the structure there? It's a bit like, sort of to take a metaphor from biology, this Waddington's landscape picture that I'm sure you've heard, right? So you take the Zugspitze or so, you know, you put your undifferentiated sort of primary cell, maybe egg cell, something like that, put on top, and you sort of let it roll into various hills, and then it sort of makes up different blood cells, other cell types in the body. And this somehow needs to be reflected in this high dimensional dot space of transcriptomes and others, because that's sort of essentially cell states transitioning. So what we and others have been doing is sort of learning that space, finding the curves, finding the sub manifolds, as we call. If you have, let's say, some very high dimensional thing, then the data typically maybe lies sort of in a plane in the data, and then you sort of want to find the plane. Or it's maybe something sort of more curved and complex, and then you want to sort of unroll that. You know what I mean? And maybe even simpler, you maybe just want to find different clusters, sort of groups of points that, because of their shared transcriptome, you then could call cell states or cell transcriptomes. And at one of the early HCA meetings 5-6 years ago, I remember discussing quite intensely with Eric Lander about, you know, what is actually now a cell type? What is a state? And this old question, when you looked into Wikipedia, there's like 9 cell types in the human brain. You know, this has been completely revamped. There's 1500 different sort of transcriptome definitions of that, and you can very clearly localize into different genes and so on. So this is just sort of the descriptory part without the effect of perturbation that has been done as a first step, I would say.
Which I think is also really, I mean, interesting now, acknowledging the complexity on the single cell level for a very long time. So when I was doing research, that was still really the general modus operandi that we did for systems biology. And I think this changed, of course, now really with time for transcriptomics, but also for other levels of analysis like proteomics, that you actually don't analyze a bulk of cells, but you analyze individual cells and therefore can also predict the individual fates of cells, which I think back in the days you would say, okay, this is a lung cell, and then you have the whole lung, of course, cells that have very different functions. And depending also if you would have a targeted drug, which one you hit, you might have a very different outcome. Where it's even, I think, easier to understand is the example that you just mentioned, the brain. If you have a very specialized neuron and you have a cell that is like, for example, a microglial cell that has a completely different function, you will have very different outcomes by perturbing those cells. Immune system would be another example, right? Absolutely. Where you have extremely specialized cell types. And here, I think understanding on a single cell level what those guys do and what we can do to potentially harness those cells and the proteins that they express as drug targets, that is, of course, really, really exciting type of research.
As a person with a non-scientific background, I must ask this question. I am stunned and fascinated by your talk right now. But if we are tackling the Virchow quote, which basically states life comes from life, and we're moving into a, let's frame it, in silico world, if you will, in a math and a numbers world. From both of you, how close have we gotten with the huge amount of data that are available right now and remodeling and getting closer to those virtual cells that might help tremendously in diagnostics, in drug development, and so forth, you name it. Maybe from math first and then from biology. So your estimation, how close are we right now with all those tools at our fingertips?
So Andreas, I think it's quite safe to say that in the sort of first 5 years of sort of computation development in these big landscapes, sort of finding a key advance was really to find essentially a bunch of sort of source cells where things started. And then we were able to connect them with trajectories and we could sort of learn these branching hierarchies.
Right.
And this was quite interestingly possible without actually us observing this in a microscope. Because typically, you know, the Virchow, for example, you look at cell cycle. You watch it, actually.
Sure.
You take RNA-seq, these things are gone, right? I mean, but because you have so many, you can sort of still see these sort of trajectories and you can actually learn that. So that's possible. The more tough thing, and you know, maybe we have a time to talk about this a little bit later, is how they react and talk perturbations, like this causal type of modeling. And that's actually what you really want, right? This is only emerging, I would say.
Yeah. I think we're still, even though AI helps a lot to integrate different data layers, we're still at a level where we're very reductionist. And we have to be, I think, because it's not there yet to have really this complete multimodal data. So all the things that happen in a cell, even at a single moment in time, are, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but beyond the capacity of current models. And we simply also don't have the data. We would have to have the data, all the right types of data at exactly the same point in time, which also is a big challenge in the field. We have data sets that come from many different sources and that are not necessarily comparable or integratable. So therefore, I think a number of initiatives, Human Cell Atlas, but also, for example, ARC Institute, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, I think also at Helmholtz, there's a lung initiative, right, of data set production that is really targeted towards really fueling these models. And I think probably that has to come first. We have to have this high quality data to be able to make this virtual copy of the cell.
Maybe one interesting aspect is, yeah, exactly as you say, you know, you start with maybe one somewhat easier to measure anchor, such as, for example, this unbiased observation of transcripts, you know, these things that are being transcribed from DNA in a setup specific fashion. But, and that's why I sort of really love, and this I think maybe also would be why I moved to this field, there's always some cool biotech colleagues that come up with another new way to measure this and that additional modality, often tacked on. It's just fascinating. It happens so fast and scales up so fast. Mm-hmm. One thing, for example, that of course people now can do, they can sort of add also a bunch of proteins. Ideally, first, maybe just labeled antibodies with some type of oligo, when you then sequence the RNAs, you also get sort of protein expression. Some others can sort of measure openness of chromatin also with a bit of RNA together. Of course, that getting everything might be a tad hard, but then you have a few of these paired data sets. Then you can use these in sort of proximal cells to actually piece together a bigger picture of having everything. So I do think there's major steps happening to get closer to this big picture of what the current state is, which is not yet answering, of course, what happens if I do something to this state. And that's where a whole lot of new sort of areas come up. So basically now that the atlas is done, we want to do a perturbation atlas. And often when people talk about what a virtual cell is supposed to do, you know, we want to sort of see where my cell types are, my new data set, stuff like that. But one of the key new things is I want to predict how it behaves under a set of perturbations. You mentioned drugs already, Louise. Could be also just CRISPRs, you know, knockout of particular genes, combination of genes. This is what current virtual cell challenges and so on typically encompass. And that's a much more recent development.
Which I think is also something that, of course, and we can see that a number of biotechs, Zyra and others, are, of course, quite interested in, because this could be very helpful for drug development or drug discovery, just understanding and simulating how a certain compound would behave in other types of cells. I think, if I got it correctly, I think from your group, there was also a different type of model for virtual cells that I found quite interesting, the niche forma, which I think is also quite interesting, because, I mean, we always think about perturbations, and I also come from a field where, of course, you think about, okay, what happens to the cell if I throw on a drug and then it dies. But in reality, the cell is, of course, not a single unit. It's not like dissociated from its colleagues. It lives together with others, which again affects the cell even under, not only under pathological, but also under physiological conditions, right? So I think also having this layer of information is very relevant, right, before we move to the perturbations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for us, this was really an opportunity to ask challenging questions to the model. In the end, you know, we have different ways of how to describe the complexity of the data. And the most powerful one, this is sort of a big learning from computer vision and large language models, is this idea of a transformer that I'm sure you've heard about, sort of one of the revolutionary paper that sort of kicked up the revolution of this large scale foundational models. This is being tried in our field. And I would say at the moment, we are sort of a bit beyond that first hype cycle, in the sense that a lot of people get now a bit sobered up that the promise of these very flexible models are sort of maybe a bit too much, and they're not yet delivering. Now is the question, why is that? And one answer we tried to do with NicheForma here was to ask, sort of to give it more informative data, namely the neighborhood information addition, and then learn a model that's not just RNA, but RNA plus spatial context. And there we could actually show in a whole set of ablation studies, so studies where you compare with simpler models, that, you know, these particular model that learns also in a fine-tuning stage about local neighborhood is able to actually predict quite some extent, and better than classical models, if you give it the state of a particular cell, typically its gene expression profile, what its local neighborhood, its niche, as we call it, would look like. That's where NicheForma comes from, niche plus transformer. So, and I think that could be quite useful, right? So without now measuring spatial context, because you can't always do it, right? But you also want to see how sort of what we often call counterfactuals would behave, what would happen if I take this cell, but then remove it and sort of, or maybe add a next to that tumor cell, I add an immune cell. I want to see how that local neighborhood would change. These type of questions we can now start addressing. Not fully yet. So I would also say here, it's to some extent early times, but the scale that that we trained the model on, I think, is quite substantial. So it's trained on more than 100 million the cells, which is then times 10,000, quite large dimension.
Which, for example, when we think a bit more like from an industry perspective, more about applicability, the question, for example, what happens if an immune cell and a cancer cell get together is, of course, highly relevant. So we have this immunotherapies based on PD-1, PD-L1 that work very well in some tumors and not so well in others, which are called the cold tumors then. And the question is how to turn them hot. So to understand maybe from a modeling perspective, and this is something that, I mean, is explored endlessly, how can we actually activate these tumors to become more responsive to this immunotherapy? These kind of questions are, of course, extremely relevant in this context.
Yeah, let me add another example. So we actually work in particular in spatial context very much on that. Tumor biology, also a lot of, you know, DNA state is necessary so that people, at least in clinics, often rely on whole genome sequencing in bulk. What we do, for example, in terms of cell therapy, I find quite exciting. At Helmholtz Munich, we have a whole set of partners, a very big diabetes department, where people are interested not just in sort of finding treatments for obesity, but also trying to develop treatments for the actual, you know, sort of loss of beta cells. And there's this exciting way that you can de-differentiate skin cells, you know, make iPS out of that, and then differentiate them into ideally full beta cells. That works to some extent, but just these protocols to make these beta cells, you need to make more efficient. This is what, you know, if you have an engineering system, what screws do you need to turn to really just make those, and not just like all these bypass ones, which, you know, make then the thing so expensive. And I think there's one or two first companies that offer some of these therapies, but that are hugely expensive. So, you know, how can you make this more efficient? Mm-hmm. And then B, of course, how can you even just understand and sort of find the right cells without, and that's always a big danger in cell therapy, maybe make those cells forget something and suddenly, you know, they sort of start growing widely and you have another problem.
Yeah, this is the engineering aspect is interesting because that's something that Jensen Huang from NVIDIA said, right? Now we are at the age where we can turn biology into engineering. I think we're not quite there from my perspective. I think the stochasticity is still too high, but there are these initial thoughts. Where would you say are the biggest payoffs in the nearer future for these virtual cell models? So how will they become useful? I think there is a lot of, I mean, academic groups, philanthropic groups, biotechs betting on the concept. So where would you say, would you bet your money for the payoff?
I mean, I'm first now speaking as a pure scientist. So of course, you know, I want to understand in the end biology, right? So I make all these fun methods that is my core expertise, but then, you know, we want to find, understand the particular biological problems. And I think you formulated a few already in the disease context. We discussed a few, but of course, something as basic, but some people call it the most important time of our life, namely development, you know, this very early time points. You know, understanding that, like having a executable map, I would just find super fascinating. Like the whole, I think single cell biology, and this may be a bit debatable, but I think sort of the most studied system could be to some extent hematopoiesis, you know, where there actually treatments are there already in clinics, right? So this hematopoietic tree has been very well understood. Having said that, just yesterday I visited colleagues in a leukemia laboratory that study this to so much extent, because there's all these different ways how that sort of very well understood system can go wrong. And then you need to find sort of treatments and ideally sort of really very closely navigatable advice for doctors. So I think for diagnostics in practice, you know, I don't think it's realistic to do a deep single cell RNA-seq of every tissue of any patients coming in. So one key question will be, you know, how can you take now and say your big data set or ideally your virtual cell, and tell me what is the minimal set of parameters that I need to measure, ideally in a very cost-efficient fashion, to then diagnose if there's ABC happening, right? And these are questions I think that these models can answer quite well. Of course, these need to be robust. And in the past, sometimes these models work well in, you know, one clinic, one data set, so to speak, and then don't generalize. So this, what machine learning is often called out-of-distribution generalization, is absolutely key. That was one aspect. I think the other one that I bet on, and there's a whole bunch of startups as well as bigger pharma going into that, is a problem that my lab sort of initially formulated something like 6-7 years ago. We called it SCGen. So this is generative modeling of a perturbation effects, particularly with drugs. And I think this idea of like just screening a big library of drugs for some effect is just coming a bit to an end, you know, sort of these, some of the low-hanging fruit. And this is, of course, not really low-hanging, but, you know, some of these sort of easier ones have been maybe found. And now the ones that are there, you maybe want to combine, you want to sort of go in a new direction. So having a system that gives you even just a little bit of advice where to bet on, and not to make a full screen, but let me just screen, let's say, 10% of that, but then you sort of have higher outcomes, or maybe understand how you can do combinatorics, which is such a big experimental space that you can never screen. You know, this, I think, will have major impact. And this is already happening now where people sort of start to optimize their systems.
I have one question for you, Fabian, one for you, Luise. Fabian first, because I think not every country has those institutions. How valuable, how good is it for our country to have non-university research institutions like Helmholtz, to be able to just do the research without teaching jobs? And other than that, you know, is this giving us an edge in the further development? Is this your take?
Yeah, thanks for raising this point. I'm incredibly grateful, particularly at this moment. We have a lot of fun, and we can answer deep questions with like fantastic minds from all over the world, just really fantastic. But I think this honor, I think this possibility to work, particularly at this time in the German system, with, even though, of course, you know, always funding discussions and so on, a robust core funding with all these extra additional industry and so on collaboration coming in, versus what we see at, you know, our lighthouse country for a long time in US. This is just such a game changer that we can do this here. I very deliberately actually joined Helmholtz for its interactive type of nature, the type of research that I do. And I think many upcoming research happens in connected labs. You know, you need to sort of have an experimental partner next door to actually ask the right question and then sort of to put into your model. And this is sort of what we do in these sort of large institutions, but this is far from decoupled from university. Pretty much all of the PIs at our computational health center, this is with now maybe 40 PIs and 500 people, one of the largest places for health AI research in Europe. Pretty much all of them are associated at one of the two Munich universities, not only because there's a whole bunch of interactions with colleagues, but also because teaching helps bring in new students, helps educate students, but then also is just an important interaction. So I think these institutes, this type of interaction, in particular for AI, if you want to sort of level higher data science, where these things come together, I think this ecosystem is really working out. And we see that we're not only doing a very good job in sort of paper writing. There was a recent Nature Index ranking of rising institutes in AI, and the 10 rising ones, I think, next to Harvard and MIT, there were 6 Chinese, and then there were 2 German ones, namely Helmholtz and Max Planck. So these things are to some extent working out. But then, of course, also the transfer into industry is something we think about quite closely. Yes. And there, I think we can learn a bit more from US, of course.
It must be something in the water in Munich, probably, that makes great minds or so. Easy. The one I have for you is, because the thing that has been in my mind since we've been talking here is that more likely than not, in each and every episode, we address the deficits in biology itself, knowing about genes. We talked about the dark genome, for instance, a whole episode recently. I would imagine that there are deficits as well, knowing, understanding. So from the get-go, you're not even able to feed the algorithm the correct data at that point. True or false?
No, that's absolutely true. But I think, I mean, this is a general problem of the type of, or the way that scientific research is done in biology, is that we, of course, use very artificial systems because we cannot study the cell in its tissue in the body because we have no way of looking inside. At least for some things, we could maybe with a microscope look at certain stained proteins. But to really study the behavior of cells in connection is very difficult in the real scenario that they would have in tissues. So in general, we culture cells in incubators that have like hard surfaces, which are not their natural way of growing. They have oxygen and CO2 concentrations that are not natural for them. They get a medium with sugar contents that might not be what they usually see. So all these things, of course, influence cells. That said, most cell lines that are used in laboratories, again, are pretty artificial because they have to be immortalized. So if I now take out a cell from my skin and put it in a suspension, it will die. So you need to somehow make these cells immortal, which means that you either often use cancer cells, which are naturally immortal. So you have, for example, the HeLa cells, this famous story that have been extracted from a woman in the 1950s, I think, and since then have been propagated and used for all kinds of research purposes. And you can immortalize primary cells or stem cells, for example. But in general, like culturing cells, we are already in a slightly artificial situation. So getting a more clear picture requires different types of methodologies. For example, if we want to do a perturbation, it's very hard to do it in the body and then follow a single cell. You can, of course, treat, for example, a whole animal. But again, for humans, this becomes limiting. So you see, I mean, there's just methodological complexity to really get an as natural as possible picture. I think there is a lot being done, for example, around organoids, around growth media, all these types of like growing organs on chips, which give you much better ideas of how cells also interact with one another and what that would do to a perturbation. But what we have to be aware of, and I think this is really the data that has been used to feed most of these models and the data that also has been used to draw most of the conclusions with our minds, has been produced under conditions that are not natural to these cells, often in cell types that are not relevant to the context that's being studied. So, for example, there were during COVID times many studies of cell lines for studying infections that really had nothing to do with the cells that would see a virus, and that, I mean, just doesn't make so much sense sometimes what you do there. I also, because I said that very negatively now, everything, I don't think that this reductionist approach per se, I mean, I don't think that the answers that we get are meaningless, by far not. And I think that a lot of biology is also transferable, because a lot of the learnings that we have as humans, we can actually deduce even from bacteria, from E. coli, we can deduce from yeast cells that are extremely simple organisms in comparison to us. But there are many principles that we can deduce by studying simpler organisms, going more and more towards complexity. And I think the more complexity the system gets, the more we have to move towards the human and towards the real world situation in order to make real sense of it. And therefore, we see, for example, studying contexts like understanding processes in the brain or in the immune system also gets more tricky, because the model organisms are less likely to tell us what is really happening. I mean, we cannot study our immune system in a yeast cell because it's just a single cell.
Makes sense.
Luisa, right, you mentioned the limitations of the sort of model systems, and I totally agree on that. And I think with organoids and so on, there's going to be some bridging things, as you hinted at. I really like the fact, by the way, that you talk about limitations. It's a very important section in any paper. Like, whatever we do, it's going to be an approximation of reality. So maybe if I can just briefly talk about the limitations of the actual models, right? Because, of course, these also just only go so far. So ideally, what I want to have is to have some uncertainty with that the model just tells, you know, this thing I'm quite sure, but this part, hey, I'm not. So, you know, better look into it. So just, you know, ideally, because it has seen so many things that, you know, yeah, it works, this one not. And here, I think what models, let's say, look into perturbations at the moment can do is to, say, predict in the convex hull, or sort of the region that you know already something about. So you can sort of go to approximate ones. But if you can really go to very strange other type of drugs, settings, cell types, and so on, this is a bit in question. Of course, in principle, the biology as well as the physics is everywhere the same. This is a different context. So it's like an adaptation of that. It's a master gene regulatory network that describes all of development. But in practice, I think the models are not yet robust enough to really learn this in general. I would think at some point, given enough and the rapid increase of this data, this interpolation is getting much, much better, not even so much in the future. So the second limitation I would see sort of conceptual is, let's say once we have this black box type of model, I mean, is that understanding? Is that a scientific theory in the sense of Popper, where, you know, you have your model, you can make a next experiment, you can falsify it. That's kind of it, but you don't really understand. It's not like, you know, this thing regulates that. So often, as with these language models, there's now simplified models being trained on top to then start to pin what these things have actually learned. So I think this explainable AI part, particularly if you want to then use these models to design a drug, to do a diagnosis, to do treatment, I think it's becoming more important.
Yeah, this is really interesting that you mention it, because I think that was the big question with AlphaFold, right? The protein folding problem, is it solved because the AI can approximate how it works, or is it solved if the human understand how it works? So it's, I think that was quickly get into a more philosophical debate. Maybe if I can ask maybe a last question, do you think, and I think this is a question that I am being asked a lot and that I find a little bit hard to answer. Do you think that transformer-based models or models of these architectures are the right ones to study biology? And do you see anything on the horizon that could work better or will complement?
Yeah, very important point. I'm just coming back from a sort of small retreat with a bunch of AI colleagues, amongst other the lead scientist of Meta AI, where, you know, we've been discussing, hey, is that it? And, you know, it could be sort of the internal transformer architecture, but it could be also the losses, namely the fact that essentially what all these things do to some extent is taking the data and then masking a few things and trying to predict that mask. And if you sort of know how to fill sentence holes, so to speak, in biology, let's say a few genes missing, maybe need to learn everything. And I think there's some, in particular, seeing now the current limitation that this might not be the best way. I think for image-based data, particularly for this sort of modality of image where there's this natural sequence nature and sort of this locality to some extent, these things actually work beautifully well, right? So image encoding as well as sequence encoding, so let's say, if you want to do DNA language models. This is, I think, a very robust approach, even though the context is not long enough to sort of learn across all of DNA. But I think for some others, we might need to do different things. And the one big learning I think that we saw from the whole development of AI is that models need biases, inductive biases. You need to put in some information to actually just do anything. And early on, we put a lot of inductive biases, priors into these models. Maybe another field, when you wanted to do language, just speech synthesis, so speech to text, you know, initially told the model, hey, this is what vowels, what consonants are. And you might have used Luis Andreas, maybe these, what's it, dragon dictator, some of these old things. They were kind of really bad, right? Like really bad. But now this stuff works because this shift was from manual feature engineering to data-driven feature engineering, because you had so many voice files that the computer automatically could learn what's important. We might not be there yet. So at the moment, we see in some of our models and many others also that putting a prior in, let's say a GRN, let's say some information from chromatin and so on, actually helps our RNA-based models. At some point, maybe we have so much data that the models would automatically find the right encodings. But I think the architectures will definitely change and be updated.
I think we should do a second episode, most definitely, because there's so much going on. Maybe we make a promise that we come back in this setting. It was a pleasure for me, especially to listen this time and not to speak, because I'm used to speaking. And today it's wonderful. Many thanks, Fabian.
Many thanks.
Thanks, Izzy.
Thank you.
Thank you as very always, much for having me.
Of course. And as always, please feel free to comment on our show, to subscribe to it. And further information, as always, at sciencetales.com. Thank you very much again. And thank you for listening or watching this episode of the BioRevolution podcast.